This is CliffCentral.com.
The Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Hi, and welcome back. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show. My name is Greg Nicholson, and I'll be your host today. Your regular host, Kingsley Kapoori, is once again away. I'm joined today by an old friend, an old colleague, and always a comrade.
Stop saying old.
Many of you might know her, the Daily Maverick's former associate editor, and the current associate editor at Tissot Black Star, which many people know as Times Media, Ranjini Munasamy. Ranjini, how are you?
I'm good. I feel like I have to have a different persona now, like a posh new business-like persona,
rather than the usual Maverick style.
Yes, you know, it's like very organized. People start work at specific times and finish work at specific times, unlike the kind of laid-back...
chaos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that that's the word.
Maverick.
Yes.
Well, thank you for coming in today. Basically, I just wanted to hang out with you, but the only way I can spend time with you these days is to interview you.
Yes, I know. We should actually do a recording, like over drinks or something.
A few more stories might come out.
Yes,
I think so.
More than we intend to.
So, Ranjini, I want to talk a little bit about. We're going to talk about the ANC today, but I was reading one of your columns, and I think it came out yesterday, on the sort of sad recent passing of Ronnie Mamwepa, who I think many people. Particularly people who've been around and been following politics for a long time would know as a government spokesperson for the likes of Cyril Ramaphosa, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, Thabo Mbeki, a former youth leader. He spent a lot of time on, I think, 5 or 6 years on Robben Island. And reading your tribute to him, it made me think about, and also thinking about, last week was Mandela Day, where you attended an event and spoke about former President Nelson Mandela. Thinking about the recent passing of Ahmed Kathrada, it made me sort of, reminded me of some of the sad state of the movement today.
Mm.
But before we get into that, I was just wondering if you could tell us about perhaps the first time you met Ronnie and what sort of a character he was.
Well, the first time I met Ronnie was in the early 90s. That's why the thing about my age is becoming a real issue. And Greg was telling me before we came on air that he was Googling me, and the first thing that came up was my age. So obviously I'm giving it away by telling the story. But I met him in the early 90s, and the ANC was bringing together at the time, people who in the kind of communications structures of the ANC after it was unbanned, and what was then the Department of Information and Publicity was holding communications workshops on how the ANC would communicating in the new kind of environment where the ANC was emerging from being in the underground to now being a political power a political party in power. And that's where I met him, and from the very first moment I met him, he was a complete and utter clown. Everything was a joke for him, until the last time I saw him, which was actually at Ahmed Kathrada's burial at the cemetery. And I kept having to smack him to keep quiet, because he was making me make me want to laugh. And we were at the gravesite. I actually wanted to pray at the gravesite, and Ronnie kept dragging me around to people and telling us funny stories and things, but that's the kind of boisterous character he was. But I think what was significant about him is that he, this larger-than-life personality, he was able to lend to the image of the ANC, as a people-friendly, an organization that it was based amongst the people. And you found that over the years, by and large, the ANC has lost that character of being in touch with ordinary people. And we've only had a few... before Ronnie became a government spokesperson, he was an ANC spokesperson. And you found at that time that he was so grounded in and rooted in the way he presented the ANC, that it wasn't... You didn't find this disconnect between the ruling party and the people of South Africa, which is what has happened, what you found that has happened as time has gone by. And I think that's the real tragedy. But once he went to government, and I think he was in the presidency first, the presidency of President Thabo Mbeki was very sophisticated, and you know, I think Ronnie at that initially he kind of struggled to bridge over from being an ANC spokesperson to a spokesperson in the presidency, because you know, he was very much that kind of informal character, but he quickly took to it, and then after that he changed over to the Department of International, which was then Foreign Affairs, but he. I think he was able to make the switch to create a kind of professionalism that you struggle to find now in the government communication service, because people I think government communicators by and large see their positions in government as being a platform to profile themselves rather than the work of government. You know, because a few of us knew Ronnie so well when he first joined government in the presidency and in foreign affairs, you know, we'd tease him about how he would start interviews or how he'd start his statements. For example, he'd say when he was at foreign affairs, on behalf of the people and government of South Africa, I would like to express. And as soon as he said that, like a couple of us would burst out laughing, because, you know, it was so funny for him to be able to take on that persona. But I must say that throughout, you know, with all the responsibilities, he was an absolutely delightful character. He did not think himself as being bigger than the job that he was doing. And I think a lot of people can learn lessons, not only government communicators, but politicians. I think that some of the people who are now in the National Executive Committee of the ANC and who serve in cabinet, you know, see themselves as being demigods. And Ronnie was in a section of the ANC that I think it was in a kind of an exclusive league. People who served on Robben Island, people who served in the Democratic Movement, who served in the Department of Information and Publicity, but remained rooted and grounded. And I think he never ever sought affirmation from anybody. He knew that he had his own liberation credentials, and he didn't need it from the people he served. And I think that was the distinction between him and the entire cohort of people who serve in the government communication structure now.
The passing of some of these ANC leaders, as well as we've seen how some of the party's most respected veterans have been treated recently and insulted by President Jacob Zuma, is such a stark reminder of where the party's at now. It sort of hits you in the face when you think of these guys who past leaders. I think looking at the ANC and how it's currently essentially on life support, you wrote the other day that Secretary General Gwede Mantashe's diagnostics report, which mentioned, I think, the Guptas, or I don't know if I mentioned them by name, but at the policy conference, went into sort of, you know, it was a sort of frank admission about some of the challenges the ANC is facing, but you wrote that I think it was like putting a bowl of milk out for kittens. I think it's important that we actually look at, what do you see as, if the ANC is on life support, what is your prognosis of where the party is currently at?
Yeah, look, the ANC is in really serious trouble, and I think the biggest reflection of that was the outcome of the policy conference, because the first 2 days of that policy conference was ostensibly to deal with the problems and to confront, you know, what they like to refer to as challenges. So how that came about was that the stalwarts and veterans had initially asked for a consultative conference, but because of a fallout, they wanted a dealing from the policy conference. So they didn't attend, but the ANC decided to do it anyway. But as you say, you know, the diagnostic report by the Secretary General was just kind of delicately approaching some of these issues. And even then, there was a pushback from some of the delegates, some of the provinces, who didn't want that report discussed. And the fact that the ANC can't even confront its problems, you know, that it actually has a debate about debating the challenges, just shows how messed up the organization is. So, yes, he did broach some of the subjects, but he was talking about state capture and the Guptas as if it was isolated from the ANC and from the ANC government. Mm-hmm. He wasn't, you know, drawing the line to where it logically concludes as to who they then corrupted. So, you know, it leaves the issue hanging. And, you know, there is some admission from the ANC about the Guptas and about state capture. And, you know, there was this call from the policy conference that there should be a judicial commission of inquiry. But, again, it doesn't say, A, who did they corrupt? B, who is implicated? And C, who should call the Judicial Commission of Inquiry urgently? They say that it needs to be called, but the person who has the power to call it was sitting amongst them at that policy conference. So President Zuma has the sole powers to appoint the Judicial Commission. The former public protector recommended in her state of capture report that he appointed. So you have this really bizarre situation where there's consensus about the Judicial Commission, but nobody is bold enough to say to the president that you actually have to appoint that commission now. So what he's done is he's taken the public protector's report on review because he doesn't agree that the Chief Justice should appoint the judge that heads this judicial commission. And the reason that Thuli Madonsela did that is because there's an obvious conflict of interest because President Zuma is implicated in the allegations of state capture. Now, there is no willingness or ability of the ANC to confront that very fact. So, you know, it's like blindfolded mice running around, trying to find the cheese. But, you know, the all they need to do is take the blindfold off if mice are capable.
Cats and mouse metaphors.
Yes, yeah, no.
The ANC always seems to do this. They're actually, you know, if you read some of the documents, some of those policy documents, they're quite good at recognizing, you know, issues within the party, recognizing even the broad issues like corruption, gatekeeping, social distance, their arrogance, the lack of accountability, and imposing leaders, issues like that they're quite frank about that. But they always do, you're right, they always seem to speak about it in broad terms, rather sort of like they're writing an essay on another political party, rather than like they have to actually act on these things themselves.
Yes, and that, I think, is the age-old problem of the ANC, where it knows what's wrong. And, you know, at every single ANC conference, you find that they know what's wrong. So, for example, at the National General Council in 2015, back then already, they were acknowledging that, you know, there's a sharp decline in membership numbers. If you remember that famous clip of President Zuma reading the membership numbers and tripping over them, that was actually to do with the fact that he was actually pointing out in that clip that there was a massive decline in the ANC's membership numbers and was a problem. And if anything, that was flagging that they were going to have a problem at the local government elections, that their own members were turning away from the ANC. But they never heeded that call, so they got kicked in the butt in the local government elections. So it was too little too late after that elections to say, yes, we know there are challenges, we know there are problems, we've listened to the people, we're going to deal with it. But between then and now, what has happened, if anything, the problems have gotten worse, because now there's this mountain of allegations around state capture, and you find that the ANC is still running away from those issues. You have, other than the call to appoint this judicial commission, what else has the ANC done to confront these problems? They haven't done anything. So yes, I think that
even the call seems a bit false.
It's false because who are they calling on? They could have said, their final resolutions could have said, President Jacob Zuma dropped that review so that there is no unnecessary delay in this judicial commission, and let the Chief Justice appoint. You know, I think that Chief Justice Mokgweng is savvy enough to be able to recognize that, yes, there is a problem here, that the president does have the sole responsibility in terms of the constitution to appoint the judicial commission, but the circumstances are extraordinary around this case because he's implicated. So I think that it, you know, the presidency has said that there's a situation where there's that it creates a bad precedent if the president doesn't appoint the judge and let somebody else do it. But I think if the Chief Justice is then given the liberty to appoint the judge, he himself can then make a ruling that will set a precedent, or that will clarify that this is not going to be the situation for every single president and every single judicial commission that is appointed from here on. That the circumstances are extraordinary in this case. Therefore, I, as Chief Justice, stepping in this matter and this matter alone, I'm appointing so-and-so as a judge, but this is not a binding situation. And I think that will settle the situation. You don't need to wait until wherever the High Court is going to review this matter, and then wait for the Judicial Commission to be appointed, whenever it is at the end of the year or next year, and you will never ever get to the bottom of this issue of state capture.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Daily Maverick Show with me, Greg Nicholson, and today we've got Tiswa Blackstar Associate Editor, Ranjini Munasamy. Ranjini, what you're saying reminds me of something you wrote last week in a column. You were speaking about the untouchable presidents, so speaking about Thabo Mbeki's presidency, now Jacob Zuma's presidency, and how we're in the process of creating a new monster that where history is going to repeat itself. How does this process work within the ANC?
So, you know, the thing is that I was writing this in the context of the current succession battle, where you find factions of the ANC rallying around different candidates and projecting these people as the answer to the ANC's problems. But what happens is that after these people become ANC president, both in the case of Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma, is that where the ANC falls down is that it has no mechanism and or no system to hold their presidents accountable. So while they put out this message that the ANC president is merely a caricature that implements ANC policy, that in fact is not true, because we've seen in the case of President Mbeki and President Zuma that they create their presidencies in their own image. So you found with Thabo Mbeki that the presidency and the administration was a hard machinery. And you know, it was very kind of technically orientated, and where things went wrong is that there was a disconnect between the administration and the people they served, and that's what created the perception that President Mbeki was disconnected from the people. Then in the case of President Zuma, is that as soon as he came, you know, he had this image of being the people's president, but then what he did was this lost control of the presidency, and then the presidency and the government machinery got molded as a system that can be corrupted, that was open to corruption and open to manipulation from particularly people who had access to him and people who were his friends. So you found that more and more the bureaucratic system was compromised. So in the case of the Vatkloof airbase landing, that the system that was in place there was compromised and manipulated to serve the agenda of his friends. And now, as you see, on this very day, the hearings in Parliament going on about how, for example, PRASA and Transnet and ESCOM were manipulated and corrupted to serve the agenda of his friends. So what you're going to have now is in December is a new president who is elected, whoever this person is, will then be given the space to structure the ANC firstly around their own image, and if they then elected as president of South Africa, the same thing will happen. But the question then arises is how does the ANC hold this person to account? Because you've seen with President Zuma in particular, is that he refuses to account to the ANC or anybody else, to Parliament, to the public protector, to anybody. He just doesn't want to answer questions. So unless the ANC is able to screen the people that they have now who are contending for the presidency to say, what is it that you will bring to this presidency? And then after the fact, after they elected, they hold them to account to those very things. Then, you know, they can mark them according to that, and they can say then at that stage, Mr. President, sorry, you undertook to appoint this judicial commission, for example. Where is it? What is the holdup? Or with whatever issue, you know, whether it's the national health insurance or anything else that they undertook to implement, where is it? And that is why, unless the ANC does that, you could very well have this larger-than-life figure again that you struggle to then rein in.
And how does the party change, or this new president, whoever it may be, change the party systems when, let's be honest, they're probably going to be elected on the basis of factionalism and slates?
Yes, that's true. You're going to have one or another faction emerging victorious in December, and those people will then bulldoze all the other factions, and therefore, you know, the first and foremost, the thing to do is to settle into power, to make sure that they arrange the ANC and create a relationship with the state where they are in control. And once that starts happening, that process then overtakes any attempt to set in place a process of accountability.
There are some ANC members, if you look at MPs like Makosi Koza, Pravin Gordhan, you look at the alliance partners, SACP, KASATU, who are speaking out on these issues. You, I think it was last week, you sat down with Derek Anacom, the former tourism minister who everyone knows was removed in the late-night cabinet reshuffle in March. And from what I read from your article, I got the impression that he felt it's either we save the party and stop its decline right now, or it's going to be too late.
Yes, you know, the one thing that was particularly significant in what Derek Hanekom was saying was that his axing from the cabinet had nothing to do with his performance as a cabinet minister. And I think that's really tragic if you look at people like Pravin Gordhan and him and the loss to the country, the loss to the state structure, where you have people who are actually dedicated to their jobs and were doing, performing well in the state system. And when you have a situation now where we have multiple downgrades of our credit rating system, you have the fact that our economy is in recession, it is, you know, really tragic that you don't have people who are capacitated to be able to correct the situation. You know, he was saying, obviously his focus now is like everybody else in the leadership of the ANC. He's a member of the National Executive Committee. He's the chairperson of the ANC Disciplinary Committee. So he's in a unique position to be able to judge what is happening as one of the senior leaders of the ANC. And he was saying that even if you have to defy decisions of the ANC National Executive Committee. So, for example, the decision that the NEC took on voting in the motion of no confidence. If the objective is to ultimately save the organization from disaster, then it would be justifiable and defensible. And that is really significant, that somebody in his position, who's the chair of the disciplinary committee, saying something like that.
While others are calling for guys just like him, or Koza for more example, to be disciplined.
To be disciplined, yes. So, you know, it's a rather extraordinary situation in the ANC now. But I think one interesting thing that we need to watch for in this motion of no confidence, whether it is by secret ballot or not, is after everything that has said and done, and everything that President Jacob Zuma has done and other senior people in the ANC have done, whether in fact that the ANC will try and discipline people, and on what charges this will be, because that I think will lead to the ultimate breakdown. You know, if the ANC, out of a sense of vengeance and, you know, throwing itself on the rails once again to defend the president, will take action against people who are acting according to a conscience and are acting in an effort to try and save the ANC. So I think, you know, and particularly because it's happening in this year where, you know, there's this high stakes game in terms of the succession battle, how many people will actually go through it? So, for example, you had in the last few days Lindy versus Sulu. Making some very bold statements on President Zuma about, you know, that he should be held to account, whether she, in fact, whether by secret ballot or not, would vote against him after what she said. And if she doesn't, what does that do to her campaign? Equally for Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, he's been speaking out rather strongly on the issue of state capture and on the Guptas and on the decline of the ANC. So, in a situation of a motion of no confidence, where does he stand? And if he votes to protect the president, what does that do to his campaign? Because he might survive in the ANC, he might even become president of the ANC, but what then happens to them? All of them, in terms of their standing, once they start campaigning for the 2019 elections.
You mentioned some of the ANC presidential hopefuls, Lindiwe Sisulu, who accepted her nomination and began her campaign on the weekend. Cyril Ramaphosa, there's obviously Zuma's favoured candidate, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. There's also others like Matthew Poza. Is Buleke Mbete still running? I'm not sure.
I think she's running backwards.
Are there any signs that we should trust any of these potential ANC presidents with transforming the party and turning it around and getting it back on its feet?
You see, I think that their focus at the moment is trying to bridge the divide between the factions, because they know that that's the only possible way that they could possibly survive, you know, in the succession race, is not to be too contrarian. So, you know, but I think Matthew Posa is, to an extent. You know, he is he's taking a stance of being extremely critical of the entire ANC leadership. And, you know, he's...
has been since his failed bid in 2012.
So, you know, he's been lashing out at everybody. Whereas with the others, they are trying to... yes, they are speaking critically about the problems in the ANC, but they are trying not to be too much of mavericks in the way they're doing it, so as to keep some of the people in the other factions on side, who are, you know, some people who are concerned about the state of the ANC, who are worried about the outcomes in December, and are particularly worried about how the ANC will fare in the 2019 election. So they're trying to keep them on board. But it's becoming more and more difficult for them to do it because they tend to look like hypocrites. So, for example, yesterday I was listening to Lindiwe Sisulu being interviewed in a radio interview on another station. And she was struggling to be able to navigate the issues that she claims to stand for in her campaign, and at the same time defend the things she kind of justified after the ANC's Polokwane conference. So it's really difficult for them to be able to straddle all of this. And I think that, you know, all of us need to bear in mind that in politics, you know, you can hardly uphold principle. And people's you know, they change. Their principles change, their stances change, their factions change, and their personalities change. So, you know, you're going to, I think there's going to be a lot of confusion in the next few months. As we, you know, people will say, but a few months ago you said this, what do you mean by that? And you must remember that in politics, as in war, and really in love, nothing is fair.
This is Ranjini Munasamy giving love advice to all the Daily Maverick listeners. So we don't have much time today. We're going to let you go in about 2 minutes. But very quickly, we've got a couple of questions on Twitter that I just want you to maybe spend just 30 seconds on each or a minute on each. Mpumalanga ANC, with its leader there, David Mabuza, which way is that going? Because we used to think that he was very much a part of the Premier League backing Zuma, which would suggest he would back Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. But lately it looks like he's wavering a lot and could be a kingmaker come December.
Yeah, I think Didi Mabuza and his, the Mpumalanga leadership of the ANC is very much the amoeba in this succession race, because you know they keep changing shape and form, and it's difficult to kind of keep track. So Mpumalanga was previously in the Premier League, you know, along with Ace Magashule and the Free State leadership and the Northwest leadership under Supra Mahamapelo. But you found that he's been trying to wheel and deal with people in the Ramaphosa camp, and that you found that people were quite confused at the policy conference when he decided that there should be the discussion on Gwede Mantashe's report, because I think the supporters of President Zuma and Dlamini Zuma were pretty much against a discussion on that report, and they were quite stunned where he decided that the report should be discussed, and the allegations of state capture should be discussed. So that shows that he was warming up to Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa's camp. And there have been, rumors that there have been these behind-the-scenes talks with the Ramaphosa camp, and that he is trying to negotiate a position on that slate. So yesterday there was a meeting between the PWC of the Provincial Working Committee of KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga. And you found the rather amusing statement coming out from the two chairpersons, Sishile Zikalala and Didi Mabuza, yesterday saying, we are calling on the Guptas to please give the ANC the space to lead. You know, it's so ridiculous. It's so bizarre that the ruling party has to ask a family for space to lead the country. and that just shows that, that KZN would ordinarily not have said anything like that on their own. It shows that they were very much muscled into that position by Mpumalanga, because they are desperate to keep Mpumalanga in their camp. But I think that they are sensing that Mpumalanga is now straying onto the other side, and they are battling to retain their support. And I think that Didi Mabuza is playing a very interesting game. But the problem with all these kinds of games is that he could end up with nothing. Because, you know, the more he dabbles with these factions, the more he opens up his constituency to be being lobbied on their own without him. So you could find that KZN starts going to the branches or to the regions and making deals there. And the Ramaphosa camp could start doing the very same thing. He needs to be confident that from start to finish in this succession race, he's got his entire province sealed, signed, sealed, and delivered to be able to vote as a as one single province. So every single person, every single delegate from Mpumalanga is going to vote in the same way. And I don't know if that's going to happen. Branches are there, or branch delegates come to the ANC conference to represent the mandate of their branch, not of their provincial leader. So if branches are swayed by one side or the other side or the third side, who's to say that they're going to follow the what their leader tells them to do? So it's a very interesting game, this. But Didi Mabuza seems to think that he's got his province locked. I don't know. As you see with the Free State, for a long while, the Free State premier and provincial chairperson Ayes Magashule claimed the very same thing with his province. But you see now that his deputy is making a bid compete with him for the position of provincial chair. And he seems to be backing the view that that Ace Magashule will not make a good secretary general, and that's the position that Magashule wants. And he needs his province to stand behind him, and they're not. There's now a split. So that's going to be very interesting, both for the Northwest and the Free State, is whether, and obviously with Mpumalanga, whether what these three provincial chairpersons have promised the Zuma camp, they can actually deliver.
Now, let's hope for Because I know you have to get back to work. So this time, maybe you can give me much briefer answers. Unless you want to go on. What's the story with this amnesty idea for Jay-Z? Is it possible or not?
It's not possible. It's not legally possible. There is nothing within the South African legal system that allows for political amnesty without the person acknowledging that they have committed crimes. And without the kind of criminal charges being laid out. So you can't have somebody say, being offered this amnesty just, you know, with saying for whatever crimes you have committed, you know, you won't be prosecuted. So anybody who is trying to present this this proposal as being feasible is actually misleading the journalists and misleading the South African public that it's possible, because it's not legally possible. They can possibly strike a deal with Sean Abrams, the current National Director of Public Prosecutions, to say he won't proffer charges against President Zuma or whoever else. But who's to say that the next president of South Africa, whether it's an ANC president or an opposition president, is going to keep Sean Abrams? So that deal that Sean Abrams undertake won't be relevant to any other national director that comes about. So the president could be charged in future. So it makes absolutely no sense to have this amnesty.
And have, with all these challenges in the ANC, have any of the opposition parties been able to capitalize on this? And do you think that they're benefiting off it when they're looking towards the 2019 national and provincial elections?
I think that there's very much a watch and wait situation from the opposition leaders. I think that they dip in and out, you know, on the issues. But I think that there's very much an appreciation amongst the opposition leaders now that the ANC is at war with itself and they need to maximize on it. But they are doing so within the context of this motion of no confidence. And I think that's where the game is being played now, you know, to be able. And I think that they've gone very much underground to be able to speak to ANC MPs on the down low, to be able to convince them to come on board and to act according to conscience. But I think the one person who's been really outspoken is there have been the EFF leader, Julius Malema, and I think that's because of the 4th anniversary of the EFF. So he's been doing several interviews, he's been speaking publicly on the issue, and he's been profiling himself as a possible future president of the country. But I think that when you see with Musi Maimane, he's very much been concentrating on DA campaigns. And I think that, from next week on, as the momentum builds before the motion of no confidence, I think you're going to find that, they're going to be speaking out much more vociferously about the state of the ANC and the chaos that exists in the ANC right now.
Ranjini, thank you so much for coming in once again.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Download the podcast, share it far and wide, and tune in next week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. This is CliffCentral.com.